Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
It's 3 o'clock somewhere. Time for a My Mochi ice cream snack. My Mochi ice cream is cool, creamy scoops of premium ice cream wrapped in sweet, pillowy dough. And get this, all of My Mochi's fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, double chocolate, and cookies and cream, are only around 80 calories per piece. Talk about a guilt-free, indulgent experience. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned, gluten-free mochis that are great for grab-and-go. So feel good while curbing your afternoon cravings or the midnight munchies. Yeah, you know who you are with the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream. Find My Mochi ice cream at Target or visit MyMochi.com to locate a grocery store near you.
Welcome to the Rose Podcast number 643.
Shut up, Scout.
Poor Scout.
Damn it, Scout.
Poor Scout.
It's the most active you've been in 2 years. Oh my God! Scout's been learning.
Now I don't speak dog very well, but I think what he's saying is that a witch has trapped his soul in a dog's body. He wants his potatoes.
Roints.
Put your dick in its mouth to break the spell.
Roints.
Don't give roints. I give roints. How dare you?
Right.
Red shirt.
Who's on this episode, Chris?
Schwing.
Oh.
Anything on the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
Oh, yeah. We got a cool one from Steven Cataroccio. And it's a cartoon show called Concrete Jungle about humans and animals existing in New York. And it features John DiMaggio, Hannibal Buress, and Open Mike Eagle.
Fucking great.
And the soundtrack is done by Merce and Recognized from Merce Day, who put out my favorite record of last year. And it's a cool pilot that they're touring around with stuff. You can go to Steven Cataroccio. That's Steven, like you spell Steven with a V. And then CARTOCCIO.com.
You just pitched off a lot of PHers out there.
Well, they're fine, but this guy spells it with a V. So
okay, we just made it. You just kind of marginalized them by making it saying like you spell it.
Stephen Stills, Stephen King, all important PHs. They got a lot of good people doing the
Dorf.
Work. Stephen, oh, the best of all of them.
Yeah.
So if you have a mixture of both, you got a good pH balance.
Yeah.
It's no secret.
Sure.
Thank you.
Hey, that was some really good teamwork, guys. You know, I really feel like we're growing as a group.
And now, this episode is two of the guys from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Rob McElhenney and Glenn Howerton. Charlie Day was supposed to be there, but he had to get sick right before. Actually, Charlie, I hope you're feeling better. Actually, I really hope you're feeling better because we recorded this weeks ago. If you're not, you need to go to a hospital, man. New episodes of Always Sunny are Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on FX.
Episode 643 of the Nerdist Podcast.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
How's it going, man?
Nice to see you.
Hi,
man.
Good. How's it
going? It's going okay.
I thought you had a beer for a second. I was going to be very happy.
Guys. Nope, just what a day to break the sobriety.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I figured 12 years. Yeah, I did it.
You should call me the day you decide.
I could do it.
I would want to be first on that. It would be like Bob Saget, then me, right?
Yeah. I would probably have like a thimble full of beer and be like, oh, what did I do? Like it would be the worst.
What did I do?
I have that dream all the time.
A thimble full of beer?
That I fucked up. That I'm like.
Wait, are you actually sober?
Yeah, 12 years.
So you have that. Yeah.
I have that recurring dream. I have it with smoking too. I quit smoking 11 years ago, and I have it too where I'm like, gulp. What did I do? Yeah. Oh my God, and I'm smoking.
Yeah, you know, like you find yourself already in the middle of it.
Yeah, I'm already. Yeah. Why did I? Yeah. What?
I was
what?
Wondering why I was having fun.
What did he? I was wondering why I was suddenly having fun.
Relaxed.
I don't crave either of them.
See, I hear that from people in recovery, and that sounds so wonderful. To
alcohol
not,
recovery?
Yes.
Or smoking recovery?
Well, I quit smoking too. And I don't, and I kind of know your feeling. Like I don't crave cigarettes. I sort of wish that I wanted to smoke again.
Makes really?
Yeah, that's yeah, absolutely.
Because I miss. That's what I miss.
You miss the satisfaction that you used to get from lighting a cigarette, and now you don't even crave that satisfaction. So you craving the satisfaction.
Exactly. I know. Yeah. I totally. So like, I kind of get that with booze too, but at the same time, I'm like, I really love the
guy. I really don't.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because great. I quit for years and years and years. I drank. These chai lattes from Starbucks every day because they're so good. They're sugary goodness. And in the new year, I just stopped drinking them. And it's been a month now. And when I think about, oh, it'd be really fun to go back and have one, I go, this doesn't sound good anymore. Like once it's out of my system.
Yeah. Now, are you drinking caffeine at all?
No.
So you stop with the caffeine.
Fuck you.
Yeah, fuck you. No, seriously, fuck you.
I have to tell you.
I think caffeine is harder than nicotine.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hands fucking down.
I'll tell you what has happened, though, is that...
Are we?
Is this happening?
Yeah, yeah, we're doing this.
We were just having fun.
We are having fun. But
we can't do both.
Yeah. But I'll tell you that since quitting like any caffeine and that much sugar in a day... I'm not as stressy during the day. I don't crash during the day, which leads me to having to have another one. I don't crave them as hard because I'm not coming off the sugar. And for years, you know, I was just convinced like, yeah, I'm not going to sleep more than 4 or 5 hours a night. I've been sleeping so much better since I quit.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
How much of this is based on vanity because you want to stay thin?
And some of it is.
I'm curious.
I'll tell you, that's an excellent question because... When I first quit drinking, it was the thing, and I actually wrote about this. I wrote a book about it, and I tell people like, if for no other reason, like let your vanity drive constructive decisions, because once you make them and get past it, then you go, oh, there's a million other reasons why I shouldn't do this. Mm-hmm. But vanity, of course, you know, of course that's one of them. But I also like feeling better. And so not doing it, like, I physically feel better.
Yeah.
But yes, of course, there is a huge vanity issue
I went off of coffee for 8 months, and I felt fantastic. Yeah. And I'm so excited about
You're
it.
More
and
even
I'm,
during the day.
I really thought I was done. And I realized I had a problem with caffeine in the same way that alcoholics, I think, have a problem with alcohol when I did the classic thing of like, I felt great. I was having a day. We were shooting Sunny. I think it was like season 9, maybe season 8. I don't remember. Anyway, and I was like, you know what? I feel good and I'm a little tired today. But I think I want to have a little espresso.
Yeah.
And it's fine now because I'm off. It's out of my system. So I'm not like dealing with the addiction. I had
wow,
it,
these are
boom,
dark days.
Like, it was so good, man. It was so good. And I felt like, you know, I felt like, you know, I think the first time, if anybody's ever done cocaine, the first time you do cocaine, you're just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
People don't do this all the time. Oh, some people do. They're dead.
And so then I was like, but it's cool. I'm not going to have it tomorrow, and I didn't. I had another one like maybe 3 or 4 days later, and then I was like, yeah, and then it started, and then it was like every other day. Then it was every day, but only at one time, and the next thing I know, I'm like right back in.
Yeah, it's funny. I had this conversation with a group of sober comics like Marin and Pardo and Greg Barrett, and I was like, how long, if you took one drink again, how long do you think it would be before you were like way back in? And they all were like, a month, 6 weeks, you know, like, because that's the trick is that you go, oh, it's not that big of a deal, and then you do it again, and then you do it again, and then you do it again.
The increments like, between, the amount of time between drinks gets smaller and smaller and smaller, until the next thing you know, and that's how it is with me.
But it is, but I think there's also the psychological component of, you know, of ritualistic behavior is really comforting, because when your life is crazy and frenetic, it gives you... just a moment that you can control, because you know exactly how you're going to feel when you drink coffee or have a cigarette or have a beer. You know exactly what that moment's going to be, and when the rest of your day is uncontrollable, and your guys' schedule must be fucking ridiculous. I mean, having to like write the show and shoot the show, and I'm sure you probably edit the show as well, and it's like, I mean, I can't even imagine what that schedule must be like.
Well, it's funny because the Sunny aspect of it is in some ways the more manageable because we've been doing it for so long that we've gotten that down to a little bit of a science. It's now the fact that we're also producing other things and now we've all got kids and we're getting older. So I know for me, I'm a little bit more concerned. Well, I was always a little concerned with the nutrition and stuff like that,
sure.
But you know, like how to feed myself so that I don't get ill and fat and ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Like finding time to go to the gym. Like that's the hard stuff, is like finding how to schedule my life and get all the work in that I want. And also not drive myself completely insane so that my whole day is so rigidly scheduled, which right now it kind of is.
I bet the kid factor really does make it, because I don't have any kids. So for me, it's like, oh, well, I just work out in the morning before I go to work. But you're dealing with children in the morning before you go to work. So
that's
you
right.
don't, you know, like that's your... Maybe you could just like bench your kids, you know, just like
oh,
really,
dude, you know.
We have weights in the office now that, like,
yeah.
that we're just to release stress from time to time, we'll just go over and.
Yeah, start. You get after those weights. Yeah. You get after those
yeah,
weights.
Yeah, because I don't have any time to go over.
Yeah. And I have to schedule time for myself to work out because that really has become sadly like some of the only time that I have. To myself, even though I'm not really by myself, I'm surrounded by beefcakes and, you know, and really obnoxious music and a trainer who's yelling at me. But
sounds
still,
great.
Somehow
sounds relaxing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. No, it's great. Yeah.
I love it though. I've been working with the same trainer guy for 10 years this year.
Wow,
he's great. He's really great. And now if I don't do it for like a couple of weeks, I start to feel like the classic moment in a movie where like the youth elixir on the witch is wearing off and she's slowly right. turning back. You know, like I feel if I don't exercise, you know, because
I'm sensing some obsessive behavior.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course, of course.
10 years with the same trainer.
It's just because I like he's just a good guy.
He's a good dude.
Yeah, he's a good dude. If he wasn't good, I would have given up on it a long time ago. He's the reason that I kept doing it. He's
now, do you find that you're as obsessed about working out as you were about drinking or
No, not
cigarettes?
Really. I mean, I go when I'm in town, I'll go 3 times a week. I go Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and I'm not a guy who's like, we got to push hard today. Like, I just go in. I like the, you know, it is. It's more ritual for me. And also... It just makes me feel better, and you know, I don't want to be the guy that hits like 60 and then goes, "Oh fuck, I should have really taken some preventative." You know, so for me, it's more about staving off the inevitable decline that we're all gonna have.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Like before, when I worked out when I was younger, it was about glamour muscles and looking good. And now it's still definitely a little bit that. But for now, me, it's a little bit more just like making sure I don't throw my back out when
that's
my kid.
Exactly right. If like, your back, like if you're not stretched and kind of and you're not your core gets a little weak, then it's like you can literally just turn around and be like, I'm down.
I'm out.
I'm down for a couple of days.
Yeah, I feel like there was that one Louis C.K. thing on Louis where he goes to like a sex store to get like a dildo for his girlfriend. I can't remember what it was. Like he just, for some reason, he's buying a dildo. It was great because the whole setup of the scene was it's going to be really awkward. He's got to go in this place. He's like not comfortable being in a sex shop and he wants to pick out a dildo and he feels weird about it. The last thing you're expecting is what the scene actually becomes about, which is him pointing to the dildo he wants and throwing his back out. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's so funny. He's like, yeah, I'll take that one. Oh! And he throws his back out pointing at the dildo he wants. Like the most humiliating moment of his life.
Yeah. You get to a place when you start to get older and you don't fall down anymore, you take a spill, and that's almost kind of the more scary thing. Like I slipped on some stairs, and like the only way it's like, what happened to you? I took a spill, and then like I was limping for weeks.
Yeah, and it used to be you'd take a spill and you'd be like, you know, you brush yourself off. Now you fall and you're like, I bashed my elbow on the desk. And
you fall down, fine. You turn it into push-ups.
Yeah.
Fell some stairs, do some dips.
Just doing dips as you're falling down the stairs. Like,
yep, that's it all the way down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
So, I saw someone fall down the Arclight Hollywood stairs once. Those huge staircases. Yeah, it was a girl. It was when I was working there, and she was like rushing downstairs and slipped on the top one all the way down.
Well, if she was rushing down the stairs, what nationality was she when she got to the bottom?
She was Crow
I imagine you watching something like that, and you can't help but think, well, first, your first thought, of course, is that's awful. Mm. She must be really injured. And then your second thought is you see them tumble down the steps for what must have been at least 10 straight seconds. You're stop.
Yeah, yeah. Just stop. Hold on to something. Yeah.
Grab
something.
Brace yourself.
Yeah, you can't
stop. Did you
stop.
Do anything,
you really
or did
stop.
You just go, hey?
No, I walked up to her and said, that's so embarrassing. Are you going to quit?
She worked there?
Yeah, she was an employee there. We were working together. I did it to kind of like be like, it's like, you know, because there was other people there to take care of her. I thought I'd alleviate the situation, and then I got suspended from work.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No one appreciated the gesture in that moment.
Not at all.
So I like the idea of seeing somebody fall down an extremely long flight of stairs and yelling at them, stop!
as if they can, you know.
Stop! Why don't you just cut that out?
Cut it out.
which I think loops back down to obsessive behavior when it goes, why don't you just stop falling down that obsessive stairway?
Yeah,
you know,
because
there's a little bit of gravity at work.
Yeah,
are you non-obsessive about stuff? Are you pretty even keeled?
I don't know. Glenn would probably be in better position to answer that.
Would you like me to?
I'd like to hear you judge my behavior.
No, you're not. No, what's funny about Rob is he gets really, really involved. Like your days tend to be really, really packed, but it's not because out of obsession. It's that you have this like thirst for experience and knowledge. So you're constantly reading books and constantly like, oh, I'm going to learn how to scuba dive. And then you'll get super into that for a while, though that's lasted longer than some other things. And now you're like super into jujitsu.
Yeah.
Now I heard you talking to somebody about, cause we're both building houses right now. And
except he's doing it with his hands.
With no power tools.
No.
I'm learning carpentry.
I think he recognizes his shortcomings in that. But I heard you talking about how you're putting jujitsu mats on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
And I can just picture. Yeah. I know what's going to happen. You're going to put the jujitsu mats. Now you've been in jujitsu for a little while. And then he's going to be like, I got to rip these fucking jujitsu mats out. I'm not doing jujitsu anymore. I've moved on.
Now I got to put the batting cage down.
You got to put the batting cage down there.
There's going to be a golf simulator.
Yeah.
Karate chop the ball. Yeah. As they come
at you, so
that's interesting. So it sounds like there might be a little bit of a. Sounds like you might be have a little bit of a, an addiction to the
change,
the feeling of discovery, like the honeymoon period with something.
Yeah, although as I've gotten older, I think I've curbed the desire to just quit after a year of something.
Right.
Like the last few things I've been getting into, I've been trying to see them through. Although.
It's tough to see it through when you don't have a lot of time. I think that's part of the issue. But yeah, I've noticed that too. Like you less and less you'll get into something and then bail on it after a couple weeks. Like you've stuck things out a little bit more. Yeah, I think it's. But you have for me, it's also trying to find things that you're passionate about and enjoy outside of work.
Oh yeah,
which I don't have a lot of those right now, which bugs me, and it's something I'm working on. I just don't know what those things are.
You especially feel the weight of it for some reason at the top of the new year, where you're like, I should start something new, new year, new. I got to start a new thing.
Absolutely.
But then it's hard. You spend more time
trying
to find
it. For me too, having kids, that kind of whipped me into shape in terms of looking at my own mortality. You know, you're looking at this thing that you've created that looks a lot like you and starts to act a lot like you and sound a lot like you, even at 2 and 3 years old. And you realize you've created your replacement. And so, you know, and I'm hurtling towards the edge of this cliff that eventually he's going to kick me off of and that he's going to be now the guy experiencing life. So I want to try and get in as much shit as I can while I'm here.
And you just got to have a baboon hold them up over an African savanna as a bunch of animals sing together. And then they bury you.
Yeah, ritualistically.
Circle of life. Is that what they're singing in that moment?
I think that's the hanging.
That's not. Right? When do they do Hakuna Matata?
Hakuna Matata.
That's the whole different fucking part of the. That's a.
It's like second act is Hakuna Matata.
I don't know. I don't watch those movies.
It's just for kids.
I can't relate to these guys. They're lions.
What do I got in common with them?
Yeah. I ain't a lion.
Hey, first of all, animals don't talk. Number one problem. Yeah.
And it looks fake.
This looks fake. Yeah.
Doesn't look real.
Everything looks, I don't know, flat or something.
Yeah.
All I know is the thing that I remember most about that movie and Hakuna Matata is when my buddy and I, Mike Furman, pass a caution wet floor sign that's in Spanish. We always go, cuidado piso mojado. That means wet floor. I don't know why.
That's
every single time that I Hakuna Matata is in my head when I see the cuidado piso mojado sign.
That's when you know you're with a true friend, is that you can say the dumbest shit that comes into your mind to that person, and they're like, I got you, man. I'm with you. Yeah. Like, my brain works that way, too.
But that's what must be fun about having a show with your friends that you are writing, is that you can basically weave all those in and make your private jokes, like, public jokes.
Well, that's the chemistry, right? Because it's funny with these guys, because the three of us are actually so different. But I'm very different from Rob and very different from Charlie. We're all so different from each other. And there's this place where our senses of humor meet, which is really nice, but at the same time, we all weirdly come at humor from a different place. So I find both of those guys so funny, and it causes me to strive to be funnier and try to be smarter, because I'm trying to reach the level that I perceive them to be at. So I like to think that in a way we sort of elevate each other in that way and fill in each other's, you know, there's things that those guys are just better at than I am. And then I like to think maybe there are things that I'm better at than they are, but it's, you know, it's nice when you find those people where, you know, they enjoy your sense of humor and make it better, elevate right. it.
And then you are also, yeah, that you essentially are all elevating each other because you compliment in the right. There's something about a specific type of person and your personality that activates the right joke centers in your brain, and you all together make a thing.
Yeah, it's like, anytime you have, I mean, I liken it to having, you know, I mean, being in a relationship or having a dance partner, which I'm not a dancer, but you know, I like to think you work with somebody who you feel like brings out the best in you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly how I feel about these guys. I feel like they bring out the best in me. I know that's the case, not to get all mushy.
Well, what's also strange is that we're not aesthetically compatible in a lot of ways either. Like we'll go and see the same movie the night before and be like, hey, did you see that movie? I loved it. And like Glenn will hate it. And I knew he hated it because I liked it. Like we have very different opinions about so many different things. And yet for whatever reason, then somebody will pitch something in the room and Glenn and I will laugh at the same time. So we have like similar senses of humor, but at the same time we have completely different ways of looking at it. I don't know why.
Well, I think that's why you can continue to, there's a difference between Sonny and then like a classic sitcom, not in just the way the show is presented, but in the way that, sitcoms essentially are written funny and then they just sort of plug people in. And then hopefully over time, it's like, oh, they find this balance between they understand who the characters are. But when you guys all know each other and the comedy is based off your actual relationships and your personal experiences, it's not like you're going to run out of personal experience. It's like, you know, Louis could make Louis forever if he wanted to, because all he has to do is just experience things and then express them. Mm-hmm. And that's such a more interesting approach to comedy than, you know.
Yeah, it's much more organic. It would be like the equivalent of writing a stand-up act and having someone else perform it.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, when you're writing your own material, writing to your own strengths, writing to the strengths of the people around you, it's a much more organic thing, because we were also friends and we'd worked together on different versions of the show and other things together prior to Sonny. So, there's that chemistry that's built in, as opposed to writing something and then casting actors. It's like, it's even more difficult for the stars to align to where it works in a way that is really, really special and unique. When you're that much, you're that extra step removed. The actors are that extra step removed from the material. So they're trying to portray something, but it's different.
Well, it's like every time they've tried to do like an American version of the show Peep Show, it's like, you know, like Mitchell and Webb, like they worked together for years and that's what made the original British Peep Show work. And then they try to do an American version where they just cast two different actors to be good buddies, and like it hasn't worked.
Like
tried
if they
it
tried
twice.
To recast Fry and Laurie, can't. Yeah. It's because Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie work well together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we get because we produce shows now too. We get a lot of foreign formats, right? And so we'll watch a DVD of a show in England that does really well. And this just happened recently, where all three of us agreed that we really liked it, which is so rare. So we're like, great, let's see if we can adapt that for American television. And they're like, okay, great. And we're like, okay, let's meet with the actors. No, it won't be the actors. Okay, will it be like the writers? Well, not really. It's like an executive producer. So what are we buying? Just the idea for the show. And we're like, well, the idea for the show is fine, but that's not what makes a great show. I mean, the idea for our show is five people who own a bar in Philadelphia.
It's not a great
special
idea.
There's not a great idea. I mean, Seinfeld was a show about nothing. The Simpsons is a family in Springfield. You know, it's about who's going to execute that particular vision. So we run into that all the time. Especially in television, you're not buying the idea or the premise. You're hopefully buying the people that create it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's another thing too. I'll get sent a script from somebody like, "Hey, I wrote a pilot. It's great." And you read it, you're like, "Yeah, it's pretty good. But check out the premise, and the premise is really, really interesting." And then you talk to them, he's like, "Well, do you want to run this show?" "Well, I don't really know how to run a show." And it's like, but that's really what you're buying, especially with a show, because a show has got to go on for years. You got to write so many episodes of that thing. The most important element of it is the people behind it, the brains, the point of view behind it. Because a premise is just like, yeah, anybody can think of like, hey, a plane lands on an island and it's and then you're stuck there.
And then
there.
You run out of it after half an episode.
Exactly. Yeah. Like... yeah. I mean, most of the more successful shows, really, the premise is kind of extremely simple. I mean, think about Cheers.
Certainly for comedies. Yeah.
Yeah, certainly for comedies. Yeah, it's slightly different. But even when you think about some of the most successful dramas, that's the case. Law and Order. Like, what's that about? Like, that's not really a premise.
Well, you see, the criminal
like
justice system is divided into two distinct parts.
Oh, boy.
Police that investigate the crimes.
Yes. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
prosecute the...
That's about as high concept as it gets.
You think?
Law and Order?
It's a show about cops and lawyers.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but the first half of the show is about the crime and then how they solve the crime.
I don't know.
Second...
I think CSI Miami is pretty intense.
Do you think that that's a format? Are you, not a you think that that's a character driven?
No, I think it's a format and not a premise.
I think so.
You know what I'm saying? It's... Like the procedural thing is like it's almost more of a format than a premise. You know, each week we're investigating a new crime as opposed to, you know, something that's much more serialized. Like, I don't watch Sleepy Hollow, but when I first saw the trailers for that, I was like, a show about a headless horseman? How many episodes are you going to be able to do about that? Like, what's, you know what I mean? And again, I haven't seen it, so I can't speak to that. But
you did.
Sorry? No, I don't know.
I know. The point is it turns you off as a viewer automatically because you don't want to necessarily.
Yeah, of course, that's just me because I know too much. But like to the average person, they might go, oh, cool, awesome. Like they'd have the opposite reaction. They'd be like, how are you going to do a show about that? Let me watch and see. As opposed to me, I'm like, they're not going to be able to pull that off. So I don't even give it a shot. You know
I think Law and Order owes, you know, part of the success to the format. And also, I always enjoyed watching the marathons just to see, like, which of my New York actor friends would turn up.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's all of them.
It's everybody's first
literally
job.
Literally everyone.
One of my first jobs.
And you can't tell me that part of Law & Order's success initially wasn't due to the fact that it was created by a guy named Dick Wolf, which is the greatest name.
It's a great producer name.
It is the greatest name. Dick and Wolf in the same. I mean, that is the.
It conjures up the image of a man who's constantly hungry for dick.
You know,
like, like a dick predator. Yeah. Like somebody who's just like, dick, you know, always on the hunt for
a dick. Hound? No, it's worse than that.
Wolf is one bigger than a. He's not a domesticated. It's not dick domesticated dog.
That's
it's Wolf. That's a wild dog.
Yeah, he'll do anything for dicks. Yeah. He doesn't. There's no rules with this guy.
That'd be like Dick Lion versus Dick Tabby.
Like, also, it kind of describes just like a shitty wolf.
Yeah,
it's a real Dick Wolf.
Yeah,
yeah, there's Dick that, Wolf, right, dude. Right. Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, that's not where my brain goes.
Well, this is a Rorschach test, and basically you see what you want. But Charlie was actually going to be here today, and then he got sick. So I will be sitting in as Charlie because we look somewhat similar, I've been told many times.
Yeah, I see you do, actually. I see that.
I could probably do the
Who's
that? Yeah. Well, it was Charlie.
Oh, yeah.
That's
good.
A little higher.
Yeah, what's up with that little bit? What is that?
Fuck you. Bobcat. Don't you cross your arms at me. There's a handful of us that are cut from the same genetic cloth. You got me, Charlie Day, Aaron Paul, and Matt Bellamy from Muse. Like, we're all, if we were all in the same room, it would be like the Twilight Zone where they like, where someone goes and picks out the type of body that they want.
You could be like the Kings of Leon. Like, yeah. You know, like, similar looks, you know. All,
yeah, all just all to the. Now, would we, if we were to perform together, would we all have a distinct spin on that look, or would we all try to, you know, like beat like early Beatles style, like all right. look the same?
I don't know. I think that would be up to you guys. I mean, you know, but I'd like to see it.
I think actually the way to do it is that we all take on the persona of different points of the same character's life. And we present those all together in one musical extravaganza.
Nice.
At the very least, it sounds like a good Funny or Die sketch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we could pull that off.
Which character do you think? Like Marty McFly? Would you guys all play a different version of Marty McFly?
It could be McFly, or it could just be all like whatever the mythos of that specific. Like we create whatever that is, and we're just all different parts of that, or different personality types of
it's
that
one
guy,
but it's different parts of his life in history, and you guys all time travel to the present to start a band.
Yeah, it's like the Beatles meets Herman's Head.
It's like the ultimate solo project.
Yeah,
it's just a band full of you.
All right, so we're gonna definitely make this now. What are you guys in season six?
Ten.
I had no idea it was 10.
Yeah, 10. I know, that's what I'm
not as a discredit to you, it's just time is moving.
No, I know.
Crazy.
It's also, I think nobody knew it was on for the first 4 years. And then certainly when Netflix came into play and we got up on Netflix and Hulu first, but Netflix is really, and also when we syndicated on Comedy Central, then it almost feels like it became ubiquitous within like the sixth or seventh year.
Yeah. It's
and then we
common.
Were getting that question a lot. What season are you guys in? 2, 3? And we were on 8.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was 6 or 7. That's unbelievable. 10. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, 10 is airing now, and we're writing season 11 right now.
Jesus. Mm-hmm. And is FX just basically, is their opinion just keep going until you don't want to do the show anymore?
It seems that way.
I think it's keep going until we can't afford it anymore. I think it's probably where they're at, which, you know, will hopefully push them to that point as soon as possible.
1 year at SF Sketchfest, which is have you guys done Sketchfest before?
No, well, you know, it's fine. We're not. It's weird because we're this
not as a sketch group, but they have panels of shows go up there.
Oh, so I see.
The word sketch is a little of it's kind of a misnomer. There are sketch groups and improv groups, but there's also stand up and panels and music shows and whatnot.
No, I don't think we've ever been invited to that.
DeVito went up there 1 year and did something with James L. Brooks, and it was some sort of a. I don't know if it was quite like a Cheers reunion, but there was a handful of people up there, and apparently no one recorded it, but apparently he told the greatest fucking stories because he had no filter about anything. Like
that sounds about right.
And the stories were apparently mind-blowingly amazing, and there's no record of it anywhere.
Wow. Yeah, no, he definitely has no filter. It's always good to have a mic turned on when that guy's around. You might get some, but you got to wade through a lot of.
You need a good editor.
Yeah, you need a good editor. It's like you're gonna have to. There's gonna be a lot of fat, and then there's gonna be a lot of fat and gristle, and then you might find a little nice little nugget of filet mignon in there somewhere.
There's a lot of marbling.
Body.
It adds flavor, but then it's not all edible.
Yeah, not as Rob said, not unlike his physical body.
Were you? I think he'd be great on the grill. Like you just, I think some DeVito steaks would be very good.
I don't know. It might be a little tough.
No, he gets massages once a week.
Oh yeah. Does he stay hydrated?
Well, with vodka.
Potato fed.
The man's 70.
That's unbelievable.
70. No, what's unbelievable is if you come out and hang out with us on a Friday or Saturday night with him, and then you see what a 70-year-old man can do. That's what's unbelievable.
Great, yeah. We'll be there. May I join him?
Yeah.
Sure. Go.
Really, he will. I don't think I've ever. I don't think I've ever stayed. Well, no, he will. He can tie it on and stay out later than any of us.
I've been at Coachella with him a couple of times, and it's mind blowing how a human being can take that heat and the sheer length of the day, coupled with whatever it is that he's putting into his body, and every different, he loves music, all different kinds of music, and he'll go to the tents, he'll go to the sideshow carnival freak type stuff. He's into it. I mean,
he's something to aspire to. Certainly, not with regard to the things he puts inside his body, but with regards to his, you know, as a 70-year-old man, he's still exploring life, you know what I mean? Like, he still finds fresh and new things interesting. He's constantly exploring, constantly searching for what's his next project going to be, you know, and he stays in touch with what's going on.
That
and
some can keep you young.
That's what he does, and that's how he stays relevant.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's why he's transcended, you know, the last three generations of television viewer, because kids know who he is, and your parents know who he is, your grandparents know who he is.
Yeah, and he's got, you know, he uses his kids as a gauge for that, because he's got, you know, three kids in their 20s, I think one's now in her 30s, but you know, and he I mean, actually, I think it was that, was it them or was it John that turned them on him onto our show?
Yeah, it was the kids.
Yeah, his kids watched our show. So when we approached him about the show, he knew about the show because his kids were fans of it. I don't think he ever would have done it if it hadn't been for that.
Oh, wow. And were you initially, was there any sort of comedy intimidation at all? Or were you immediately like...
We didn't want to do it.
Really?
Yeah, no, we got forced into it. I mean, in the beginning, we had a show without him. The first season was without Danny. And then nobody watched it. And so John Landgraf, who's the president of FX, he called me in for a meeting and was like, hey, no one's watching the show, but we love it. We want to keep it on. But we don't have any money for marketing, and we need to add somebody with some panache that we can hopefully parlay into some public relations story just so we can get people talking. So we were really reticent, you know, to add anything to the chemistry, you know, that might destroy the chemistry of the show. And they started knocking around different names, and Danny's name came up, and we were like, well, I guess that kind of makes sense.
And Ted McGinley, I'm sure. Was Ted, yeah.
Well, it's not that we were reticent to the idea of adding Danny to the show. It was that we were reticent.
Specific to Danny.
Yeah, it was that just we were reticent to add a name to the show. You know, because we kind of liked that we were no names and that it was this weird small thing, you know.
And you also don't want it to be all of a sudden that guy's show.
Yeah,
right.
You've built this thing. Yes. It's like... Oh, well, now it's the Danny DeVito show or the whoever else comes in, and now we got to write for that guy. Then
you don't
want to
add in Pucci.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was, and I remember our first reaction was like, you know, no, I don't think we want to, do that. And they were like, oh, okay, well, then, you know, the show's over. And we were like, well, you know.
I mean, we'll consider it.
Yeah, we do. We would. So then Danny's name got brought up, and I went over to his house and talked with him, and he was exactly who you imagine him to be. He was great.
Yeah, I mean, as in terms of the kind of names that were being thrown around, Danny was perfect because, you know, he's one of those guys, he's made a career out of playing, not that he played only despicable characters, but he's played a shitload of despicable characters, and our characters are kind of despicable, but we like to think that they're lovable in their own way, and, you know, Danny's one of those guys, very unique career of a man who's played so many despicable people, and yet everywhere he goes, you'd think that he always played the happy uncle or dad. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, people love that guy. But I think it's because they do love despicable characters. But he's such a lovable, likable person that I think you sense the warmth and likability underneath all of the despicableness. Yeah. And that's why people like him so much, besides the fact that he's really fun size. You know, people like fun size things, you know what I mean? You know, what would you eat? Would you eat a Snickers bar? Would you eat three fun size Snickers
bars? I mean,
bars?
That right there, that's three times the fun. Yeah,
that's right.
It says fun right on the package.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
I always thought fun size was a genius marketing campaign for charge you about the same for a lot less of the thing. Like, that's. Oh, well, it's fun. It's worth it. I mean, the other ones...
That's right. You're paying more for the extra fun.
What do you get? I just get this weird... This other one's just this dumb plebeian brick of boring chocolate. You know, like, fun is... Who doesn't want that?
Yeah.
I think
that's
how Danny's agent talks to... that's how he negotiates.
It doesn't take up much space. Come on, hire him.
Yeah.
Instead of a trailer, you can set up a Mini Cooper just put a toilet in it and it'll be fine.
The irony being that his trailer is by far the biggest.
Of course. Of course it is.
I think he's earned that. He's 70.
He's earned it.
Yeah, he's absolutely earned that.
But he bought it for wasn't War of the Roses. It was
Ruthless People?
No.
It was later in his career then. Right?
No, it was earlier. What was the one he did with Michael Douglas that you love?
Romancing the Stone.
Romancing the Stone.
Yeah, it was for Romancing the Stone.
So
that's
pretty smart.
How old this thing is.
It's pretty smart, though, because what he does, he bought the trailer, but then he charges the productions that he
to
does.
Rent
like,
to rent it.
Yeah. So he's paid that. He's paid for it. You know what I mean?
But the problem is...
That's a great idea.
I'm telling you, man, there's so much money to be made from chargebacks because you just go, well...
you're going to rent this from someone else anyway.
That's right.
So you kind of give them a little bit better of a deal. It's a genius.
We figured that out a few seasons ago.
Yeah, we're working on that.
But yeah, here's the downside. Danny's trailer, since it was bought in 1984, it was built in 1983. And I don't think it's been updated since.
Posters of Heather Thomas inside.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks pretty good for a trailer that old.
When was the last time you were in there?
Well, every season.
It has a VHS.
That's cool in its own way.
It's unfortunate that there's no way to interview a trailer. To just the stories.
Yeah.
Just the stories. Like, if you could animate an object,
right.
That trailer.
Whose trailer would you want to interview? Out of any celebrity and any movie star,
I think you got to go. I think you got to go for a dude like Stallone or someone who was really famous in the '60s and '70s, when you could basically get away with anything,
right?
And there was like people weren't as concerned about like there was just. You know, there was more random,
less sexual lawsuits. That's what you want to say, but afraid to say.
I was saying like just more where I think people
less accountability because
less accountability back then.
Yes,
you know, way more.
Not everyone had camera phones.
No,
right.
Way more drugs. I don't know. Maybe there's just as many drugs now, but I always think of the '70s as like that's when people were really.
No, they were definitely more back then. I mean, it's not that they're not around, but I think it was just it seems like it was much more out in the open. I mean,
it was much more social
because you could cheat on your spouse and there was no way for that person to ever get back in contact with you.
Right.
Now you're one step away from just literally
Twitter,
texting
Facebook,
somebody's spouse and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
So
Warren Beatty
would have a great Well, Bob Evans wrote a book, but I'm sure that would be an insane let's see. Warren Beatty would be pretty amazing.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Beatty.
You're going to go with Beatty.
Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
What was he doing?
It would be the most boring thing. Finally, we get to know what he was doing the whole time. Working out.
Fuck. Why did I pick Schwarzenegger? Oh, man. Shit.
Tom Cruise?
No, I don't think Tom Cruise's trailer would be that interesting. I think it would really have to be like Burt Reynolds probably had a pretty interesting trailer.
But so did Dom DeLuise.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right. For a different reason. Right. I don't know what that is, but there's something going on in there.
Yeah, why Dom DeLuise?
I don't know.
What do you think was going
on
there?
There's something.
I think it probably just smelled like farts the whole time. You know what I mean?
Marty Feldman's trailer. That's what I want to know.
You want to know what's going on in Marty Feldman?
Yeah, yeah. Weird shit.
Eye charts and shit. Like, fucking just.
Who else back then had a
Lee Majors.
Lee Majors.
From on the TV side.
Sure.
Yeah. Charles Bronson.
Because Lee Majors, you got to think volume in short bursts. Because, Schwarzenegger would assume, well, this is never going to end, right? Because I've been a movie star, I'm going to be a movie star.
Yeah, but he was like a voracious sociopath. I mean, that he was getting after it, like, regardless.
But, Lee Majors knew it was a finite amount of time.
Do you think he knew? Right? No one ever knows. Everyone, I think most people think, this is going to last forever.
You know what? I think maybe we got to go farther back when I think the disparity between a person's public image and their private life was immense. Like, I think you got to go,
Cary Grant?
Hugh Beaumont, or, someone unassuming on television that you would never think anything about because they played, a TV dad. But in their private life, it was probably harnesses and Bakelite dildos because
Mike Brady.
Plastics. Yeah, of course.
Right?
Oh, yeah, there.
Of
who,
course.
Who?
Mike Brady. What was his real name?
Right.
Robert Reed.
Yeah, Robert Reed. So he had a completely different life outside of that show.
Raymond Burr, who played Perry Mason, had an island and a completely different kind of had to lead a very secret life.
Why was his life so secret? What was he getting into?
I believe he was gay.
Oh, he was?
And
I didn't know that.
Kate, do you want to look that up so I'm not slandering anyone?
Check the internet.
Raymond Burr, Burr.
Well, what's the bigger slander? Saying it or saying that it's slander for saying it?
For saying it. I mean. Yeah,
right. That's a gag. Good question.
More slanderous to me.
It's only slanderous if the recipient perceives it to be that.
Yeah.
But, but particularly actors of that time, like Robert Reed and Raymond Burr, there was zero tolerance for gay culture.
Right.
And so they really had to.
Yeah. That Ray. Oh wow. So he had a whole island of fantasies happening. Like
a good time.
You shipped him in. You know.
Albert Via Shade. That's the trailer you want.
Oh shit.
I bet you Merv Griffin had a few islands.
Oh yeah.
Merv.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, he had more money than most people. In
Oh my goodness.
The entertainment industry.
God, in those days. Oh. You imagine owning a piece of a television show like in the 70s, owning a bunch of TV shows in the 70s.
Oh, it was insane. I mean, now it's just so hard to make that. You just can't make that kind of money on television now, not even on network.
No.
Because there's just too many things to, the audience is too spread out.
You know? And now they, you know, now networks do this really funny thing where and there's no real rhyme or reason behind it, but they'll go, well, we're going to shoot a presentation. We're like, you mean a pilot?
No. Yeah.
It's a pilot, but for less money. Oh, so you don't have to pay everyone. You want everyone to work for free.
That's the one.
Yeah, well, presentation. That's
the one. The thing that I've experienced lately is they go, it's like, we'll give you money. You make a couple scenes from it, knowing full well that everyone that hears that is going to go, fuck them. We'll make the whole thing for that amount of money.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. That's
what I'm dealing with right now. It's what I dealt with last year.
Yeah, because it sucks. Just benefits you to give them the full show.
Yeah, exactly.
So they can see what it is.
And then they see how well you made it for how cheap, and you go, but that's, I had so many favors.
But you did it once. No, you could do it again.
It was nothing but favors.
I don't know. Yeah. You can do this every week.
We just did that, actually. We just did a presentation because they weren't totally sure on the thing, and we did exactly what you said.
Yeah.
We were like, let's just shoot the whole thing.
What other shows are you producing?
I just directed a pilot that we produced for Bill Burr. Do you know Bill Burr?
Nice. Yeah. I think Bill might be the best comic comedian working.
Yeah,
today.
He's amazing. Hmm? He's amazing.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah.
He's the star of it. He's married to, in the show, he's married to Regina King. Uh-huh. You know Regina King?
Yep.
And have you ever seen Black Jesus?
No.
Have you not? Man. Oh, you got to check that out. Yeah.
On Adult Swim.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that show's great.
Yeah.
I
believe
it.
The premise is just that Jesus has in fact risen. And he lives in South Central.
Yeah, I don't know that they go into why he's Jesus, but basically this guy, Gerald Slink Johnson, plays Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. the Lord and Savior. But he lives in Compton
Something? Maybe.
He lives in Compton and just hangs out with his homies.
Yeah.
But he is Jesus, and he talks to Jesus, but he just hangs out and like smokes weed all day and stuff. Anyway, it's really funny. The guy who plays him is the third lead in the show.
So that's a series for FX, and we just delivered the pilot, so we'll see what they have to say about it. But Bill was great.
Yeah, it's like I'm loath to talk about some of them because I've got a show that's coming out on Ovation. We have a show. It's a music documentary show. It's not a comedy at all. It's totally off brand. But
What is it?
It's called On the Record with Mick Rock. You guys familiar with Mick Rock? He was a rock photographer in the 70s. Well, he still is. He still, you know, is a major photographer, but he was like known as the man who shot the 70s because he shot Iggy Pop and Lou Reed, David Bowie.
He's the one that did the famous Iggy Pop when he's like standing on top of the crowd, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that was Mick Rock. So he's our host. He's a madman. He's hilarious.
Well, he probably has better stories than DeVito's trailer.
He's got amazing stories. It's kind of a travelogue. We go to different cities, meet up with different artists.
Oh,
it's
great.
A music documentary show.
Yeah.
What else we got? I feel like we have
an animated series. Well, again, that's
It's like fun. Some of these things are in the like the music documentary show is definitely going on the air. The other things are more kind of in development, or we've shot a pilot
in various stages of the process, or being held up by legal departments of various entities.
That's right. That's right.
It's always really fun.
I did produce a movie though that's coming out February 20th that I'm very excited about. Yeah.
What is it called?
It's called All the Wilderness. Mm-hmm. It's an indie, so it's limited release, but there's some great people in it. Cody Smith McPhee. Virginia Madsen, Danny's in the movie, Evan Ross, and Isabel Furman. So it's a great cast. It's a really good movie.
I met Virginia Madsen somewhere sometime, and she was a riot.
Mm-hmm.
She was great.
Yeah, she's really funny. But yeah, it'll be in theaters February 20th and video on demand at the same time.
Nice. If you go to the ArcLight, you can see people falling down the stairs.
You could see some jackass kid introduce it.
Was she okay?
Yeah, she was fine.
Okay,
she was a bigger girl. She was fine.
All right,
she didn't have to put that in. What is that?
No, she was like she was like she played sports. She was like a she's
strong.
Girl.
She was a strong girl.
Yeah,
fit. Okay.
Yeah.
This is what I'm talking to say. I keep going back to this. I feel like, and again, I could totally be wrong because I've never fallen down a flight of stairs. But I feel like if I was, I'd be able to fucking stop myself. Is
well,
am
that's
I wrong?
A long, that, yeah. It's a
when,
steep
when you've got that
of,
much fucking yeah. time, when you fall down that many.
Yeah, but you know those steps as the arc light? Like, it's yeah. pretty steep, but I. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Don't but you feel yeah, like you'd be I able to like, stop yourself after like, you just like.
I'll bet. What I think it is. I think it's like there's moments where you try to stop yourself and you only end up like making
propelling,
it worse.
Yeah. Like if you don't.
Yeah.
Just
firing yourself off in a good direction.
You grab at something and then you swing. Yeah.
Right. So just make it worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's better to
like the Untouchables.
Yes.
You like grabbing for a baby's, you know, carriage. Yeah. Down.
People taking other people
you
down.
On the way down.
Andy Garcia is going to slide in and catch the baby. And,
yeah, it's probably better if it's like when you take a tumble, you know, skiing or snowboarding. We just, it's better to sort of get into the position to not hurt yourself yeah. as you go down.
God damn it! Because you don't want to stiffen up an arm to try and stop yourself because you could break.
You break your wrist.
I'm sorry to ruin the momentum of this conversation, but. I just remembered how much I loved Andy Garcia in The Untouchables. I had completely forgotten he was in that movie.
Yeah.
And he was fucking great.
Yeah.
He was fucking, everyone was great in that movie.
Yeah.
It holds up. The Untouchables holds up.
I'm loath to say it, but I've never seen that movie.
What?
I know. It's crazy. It's been, I literally bought it to watch it, and I just have not seen it.
I think if you watch it for the first time now.
Brian De Palma, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It might feel, you might go. Oh, it's one of these movies. But when it came out, it was a completely unique...
That's kind
of
why I'm afraid to watch it, because I just am afraid I'm not going to be able to appreciate it now as much as I would have appreciated it had I watched it 20 years ago, or even 15 years ago. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then I'm just going to be like, well,
Oh, it was
you
fun.
Like
it,
you like Costner?
Yeah, I do.
That's him doing his
thing. I like all those people, and I like Andy Garcia. I love Sean Connery. He's in it,
yeah.
right?
He is in it,
Robert
yeah.
De Niro?
De Niro's in it? Yeah. Come on, yeah. He's a good guy.
Check it out.
I am. Yeah,
check it out. I like De Palma too, sometimes. Snake Eyes, not so much.
He's had a couple of misses.
He's, you know, yeah, he's
making a movie is hard.
Yeah.
You know, like
making five a year is even harder.
It's a very difficult process.
Although, let's give Brian De Palma a little bit of credit on Snake Eyes.
No!
He's got a Birdman like oneer at the beginning of that movie. That goes on for like, I don't even know, like maybe 15 minutes. It's really? All shot. The whole beginning of that movie is shot as a wonder. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
It goes
yeah,
in and around a boxing. Did we watch it
together? Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's pretty astounding. I mean, there must have been cut points in there somewhere, but I mean, literally, I mean, you know, everybody is tripping out over that wonder in Birdman, because, and they should. It was incredible. But De Palma, for such a bad movie, did such an amazing wonder at the beginning of Snake Eyes. It's worth seeing the first 15 minutes of that movie just to watch that.
I almost think they could teach an entire class around Birdman and just the technical marveling that was, because I just when I was watching, I'm like, okay, that definitely there was a bit of a dark spot there. That could have been the cut point, but it's still, you know.
Well, look, if you can make the Avengers, I could make anything look like it didn't cut.
Right.
Really, yeah. I mean, but it doesn't change the fact that you would still have to choreograph it in a way. It doesn't matter if you cut; it's still shot as a oneer, and that's almost just as impressive to me. As actually making it a wonder. It's like, I almost don't even care. It's just the fact that you were able to choreograph one camera to make it seem like the whole thing was just continuously shot.
We did an episode like that this year.
We did.
One continuous shot that's, how long, 13 minutes?
It's long. It's like 13 minutes long.
Yeah, 13 minutes.
And it was actually coming off the, Birdman hadn't come out yet. It was coming off the heels of that wonder from True Detective that everyone was talking about. Amazing wonder that's in that movie. And we had a story that felt like it supported that. That type of storytelling, doing the wonder thing, and so we just, as a challenge, and we're 10 seasons in, you're looking for ways to, you know,
spice it up,
you know, spice up the marriage,
invite another lover into the bed,
yeah, exactly. Try some butt stuff,
yeah.
You know,
try butt stuff, yeah,
yeah, try a little, yeah, butt
all
stuff.
All right, time to try some butt stuff.
Yeah. Here's the 13 minute butt stuff. Have you ever thought? I think people's faces would melt off with rage if you did that, because people hate change, but. It, let's say you get to, like, you know, you're like season 15 of the show, and you're like, you know, fuck it, and you just, something happens and a meteor lands in the city, and then everyone gets superpowers and the show completely genre shifts. Have you ever, like, when you're pitching ideas, do you ever, just by getting to that point where you're like, you know, why not?
Well, I don't think we would ever want to do anything that would change the entire trajectory of this. I will say, though, if we collectively decided that we were going to do like a South Park thing, just like kind of keep it going forever, The Simpsons or whatever, maybe we would do something like that. But what we will do is entertain the idea of you know, it's just about finding the way in. But mm-hmm. like, you know, in season four, we did a whole episode that took place in the 1776.
Right.
You know what I mean? But you got to figure out a way to sort of, as our characters telling a story of something. That
yeah.
happened.
A meteor lands in the city mm-hmm. and right. you all touch
we could
it.
Do that for, we would probably do that for an episode.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done a couple of horror, actually one intense horror episode,
mm-hmm.
but it's still a comedy. It's still like bending the genre, but not really. It's still a comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always sunny in Krypton. Like you just, it's like a pre Krypton mm-hmm. destruction. Everyone.
Just kind of yeah. I mean, I think what we
so
could
you
get away with
you
it.
You don't have enough superhero movies in the fucking you have to have it in TV.
See, the irony is that it's the sun that ultimately destroys the planet,
right?
So
is that what happened with Krypton?
Well, it doesn't. Doesn't their sun like something unstable about the core, and then
I couldn't understand a word that came out of Brando's mouth, so I don't know.
That's why the council didn't believe him. They were like, I don't know what the fuck he's talking about.
I'm going to convict him because I can't understand him. I'm going to act like what he's saying is false when really I can't understand.
Planet's going to explode. Our lawns are going to get mowed. Why is that a problem?
Why is that a bad thing?
Our planet's going to explode.
Isn't the most recent one that they did? The most recent Superman, wasn't it some allegory to climate change? I feel like every movie is some allegory for climate change now. Yeah. Where like something that they did, something that the what's the race called? Sorry,
The Kryptonians?
What are they, Kryptonians?
Well, they're from Krypton. Yeah.
Okay. The Kryptonians did that, accelerated this process of their own destruction.
Well, we're not right. called Earthians.
We should be
Earthlings.
We are Earthlings. Earthlings. Okay. All right. Fine.
I think in the Richard Donner version, it was just if you don't listen to Brando. What are you guys going on about?
Just you know, reveling in being Earthlings.
Sorry.
It's a self-realization.
What's your favorite Earthling thing to do?
Breathe oxygen.
Mine is to assume that everything we do here is the greatest thing in the entirety of the universe.
It's not?
Nope.
Oh.
Earthling. So Earthling.
Vain Earthling.
Vain Earthling. I like referring to people as humans, but I think now Earthlings is kind of fun.
Change it up a little bit. Absolutely.
So you do have the freedom within an episode. It's like you said, you just have to find whatever mechanism that justifies why.
Well, look, I think at this point, I think if all of us got really turned on at the idea of doing a really out there episode like what you're talking about, like the whole, it's just, we're like, I don't think we would have any qualms about, if the three of us were really passionate, we'd be like, let's do an entire episode as if the show took place on Krypton.
Right.
And we all really wanted to do it. I think we'd be like, oh, fuck it, I don't care.
Right.
Let's just do it. And not even explain it.
And
let's just do it.
Yeah. Because your audience understands, like, sometimes they're going to do stuff in their
we did a sequence in which we push into Charlie's head and into what he's thinking, and he thinks in cartoons, so it's a whole episode of us animated.
But even that's more grounded than the idea of just being like, we're going to do an entire episode as if this was a bar on the planet Krypton. By the way, I'm warming to this idea. The more I think about it, I'm like, you know, the more we scramble for new ideas, the more I'm like, yeah, fuck it, let's just do, you know. I would not be against doing something like that, not explaining it. And then the next week, you're just back at Patty's on Earth, and who cares?
Just like someone's wearing a dirty T-shirt, but it's like that kind of reflective black with like a silver, like the weird, with like the weird
symbols.
Like the Kryptonian letters.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Just everyone with just pointed shoulder, you know, like old, like
just
the 60s.
The laziest set dressing.
Yeah, exactly. Like really
as long
bad.
As you dress the space patties.
As long as you dress DeVito up as Zod, I think.
Yeah. I definitely like the idea of everything being space. So yeah. It's like another would you like another space?
Space?
Yeah. Yeah.
We're just in space. You could just call it. Well, you don't have to.
Well,
you gotta hit the space head.
Typical Earthling.
I gotta hit the space head. Yeah.
Right back.
That'll be 20 space bucks, please.
Yeah. Space bucks? Why are they space bucks?
yeah, fuck it. You know, why not? I think we've earned that right. You know, I don't know if we'll do it, but I think we've earned that right. I'm not against it.
So how do you guys bring in when you have, how much time do you have off from the show? Like, what's your production year like?
It's about 6 months from writing, shooting, and cutting. Maybe 7 months.
It's actually pretty fast.
That's great.
It is. Yeah. We like I said, we surrounded ourselves with a lot of really great, smart people in terms of our crew and our post-production team. A lot of people who have been with us since the very beginning or close to it. And, you know, a lot of people just are really good at their jobs, and it makes us be able to do it much more efficiently. And the only reason we've been able to do it this long is because we cut the episode order back to 10 episodes a season, and we can do it in a way that allows us to have lives outside of the show. Otherwise, I think we would have gone nuts.
Do people constantly say things in front of you and go, you could use that? Like, do
almost
they just
every single day.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Good, because I have an idea. Okay. I'm sure this is... It's just my liking to see universes collide.
I love it. By the way, I'm all for it. It doesn't mean we're going to do it. But okay. I'm all for it.
So,
by the way, sometimes this happens and we have the person write it and then we go and make it.
Oh, yeah.
I think it would be really amazing if you and Louis guested on each other's shows, but as different perspectives of the same experience, where you cross paths and on your show it's more your guys' perspective and Louis's kind of the guest. And then if you were to watch the Louis episode, he would be in the foreground and you guys would be in the background so that you would get this kind of like
and
two perspectives.
And it takes place in Fargo.
you know what's interesting? Amazing. I think you could absolutely do something like that. The place where my brain goes is because in my mind, Sonny weirdly takes place almost in like an alternate universe where the rules are very similar to what they are in the universe, the dimension we live in, but they're just ever so slightly askew. However, I will say that that's really only the case with our characters. Like when our characters go out into the world and we meet, you know, we sit across the desk from a normal guy. He's looking at us like, what planet do these people live on? You know what I mean? Because so in your scenario, because Louis's show is so grounded and so
real. But it's sort of like that as well.
He goes into tangents. Heightened reality.
Yeah, of heightened reality. It's all
right.
It's looking at the world through his perspective.
Right.
So sometimes in that.
You can do that.
His girlfriend, or a woman he's on a date with, gets on a helicopter in the middle of the date and flies off into the city.
The garbage men come into his apartment.
I just think the creative exercise of you both, you know, he shares an experience with you guys, and then you both come away interpreting it in different ways, but it's still, you know, it's still connected by, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. You don't see that very often anymore, these crossover kind of things. And, you know, I mean, certainly the request I get 100,000 times a day on Twitter is that they want us to do a crossover with Workaholics. Which makes a lot of sense in many ways. And I love those guys, and I think that show is really, really funny. You know, so it's funny. I guess it's I mean, I don't know why we don't entertain it more. Maybe just the logistics of it seem a little bit daunting. Like, how are we going to... But I don't know. I mean...
It was just my way to pitch a mildly cringy idea just to see.
Call Louis and see if you guys
over with the Property Brothers on HGTV, and they're going to help you find a home.
We've been talking about a crossover with Game of Thrones, which I think would be...
That'd be great.
How would that work?
It wouldn't.
But
those guys wrote an episode of our show.
They did, yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if anything, it would be, you know, it would be like the kind of the Krypton idea where it would be Sonny.
Is Danny Tyrion?
No, they wrote an actual episode.
Oh, I thought
of
you
Sonny.
Meant there was a crossover you guys played.
No. They wrote an episode of Sonny two seasons ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of happened like this, where we were out to dinner and they said, hey, we have an episode we want to pitch you. And they pitched it to me, and I was like, yeah, that sounds good. And they came in and wrote it, and then we didn't have to write that episode.
Right.
It was one less episode for us to write.
Yeah. So was that strange to basically be saying someone else's...
No, well, because we had them... There was a little bit more of a process there. We had them come into the writer's room, and we would pitch things, and we would kind of walk them through how we break an episode, and then they did a draft, and then we
sonnified it with them a little bit. I mean, they came in with a really great idea that really sounded, I mean, very much like an episode of the show, and which you'd be surprised at how often that's actually not the case. Somebody thinks they know what the show is, and they pitch us this thing. It's like, that's so not anything.
Sort of like what Chris just did.
Exactly. Exactly.
It wasn't that bad. It was pretty good.
It was pretty good.
No, you don't have to. It's fine.
Hey, don't be so mean to him.
Hey, who side are you on?
Hey!
I'm on no one's side. Yeah. I'm on my side.
but they came in, and we just boarded it out, you know, and beat it out and kind of changed their break a little bit, went through the beats, you know, and then they went off and wrote a draft. We did some rewrites on it, but they gave us a pretty... I mean,
it turns out they're talented.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. You know, I get a lot more comments from the community of drama television writers than I do from, and I think it's the same. Like, I think for drama people, when they go home, you know, you spend the entire days breaking dramatic stories, really heavy shit. When you go home, the last thing you want to do is then also sit down and watch Breaking Bad.
Right.
No. You want to go home and you want to watch Sonny, or you want to watch The Simpsons, or you want to watch Workaholics. You want to watch something that's just like light and God, you know. So there's that's a lot true. Of people like, in the drama world who are like bigger fans of our show than people in the comedy world, because it's not like when I go home, I don't want to watch comedy. I spend my whole fucking day working on comedy. I want to watch heavy.
In the
awful.
Last 5 years, the three shows that have reached out, like various members of three shows that have reached out to us to say they like the show or come to set or we become friends, Game of Thrones, Mad Men, and Breaking Bad.
Oh wow!
So it's right. Like zero comedy people. And I think that people just don't – they're like us. We go home, and I would rather watch Mad Men than watch Parks and Rec, not because I don't think Parks and Rec is a great show. It's just I'm doing that all day long.
Right. Yeah, that's not taking a break from your work. In a way, I'm going to watch a comedy.
You're going to be analyzing it.
Criticize it, analyze it. You know, and it's like I don't want to do that. You know, and that's not that I don't watch any comedy. I do. I do watch some, but not much. I mean, mostly I want to take a break from comedy and watch something else.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. I'm kind of the same way.
Yeah.
I do watch the True Detectives of the world, which I still was hoping there'd be some weird supernatural element at the end of the show. I thought that's what they were leading up to.
They did.
They didn't.
Huh? What are you talking about?
The True Detective?
It was
the entire final sequence was completely supernatural.
No, that was all an extension of all the drugs that were in his brain. He was having those weird visions. I don't think it was actually...
Wait a minute. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the most disappointing...
He went out to a little cave and found the man and then
But he saw that weird spiraling... That weird spiraling universe is sort of a reference to the, I believe, just all the lore around Carcosa and like throughout our... throughout literary history.
Right.
Because it dates back to the 19th century. Like they're kind of the constant references in that show to this old story that keeps getting retold. But I read that as like not... Because I think if there were something supernatural, they would have paid it off more. Because now they're just scrapping and starting over, so they're not going to expand on that. I think it was just because he had those weird visions throughout.
Were you disappointed in that final episode?
Yeah, yeah, I was. Like, I felt like
it was 10 episodes of building up to
this insane.
Big,
and all of a sudden it's like they shoot him in the head, and they're like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Now they're in the hospital making jokes, you know, like that was. The,
and
like,
also that he believes that the light is winning, right? Wasn't that like one of the final lines? That,
yeah,
like good is triumphing over evil.
Yeah,
but the series didn't tell that story.
Lots of people died.
Yeah, and I don't know. I liked him in his dark place.
To me, I thought the show was building to something really big, but it ended like. The end of a procedural,
right?
The end of an episode of just a regular procedural CSI type show,
sort of like Serial without even an ending.
yeah, exactly. Right.
So it's like all of that, and also not ending,
right?
Just no closure. The same thing.
Yeah, Serial was a big. Oh, God, it was entertaining many times, but. There were a lot of times where I was listening to it and I was like, I'm going to stick this out because I've spent so many hours with it already. I may as well see what happens at the end. And then at two episodes towards the end, I was like, this is not going to end well for me.
But were people that upset with the first Paradise Lost documentary when there was kind of – they didn't know who killed him. They didn't know with the West Memphis 3 documentary.
Yeah. Right?
I mean it was 15 years and 3 documentaries worth until they actually got somewhat of an ending. And they're still like they're not sure who killed those kids.
Yeah,
so it's like it's very similar. Like
I would argue that is in many ways a better story, though.
Yeah, well, there's more at stake. I mean, if Serial had delved into the racial implications of that town, like how in Paradise Lost they talked about like the against the occult and death metal and stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
It's just super demonstrative of what we need in storytelling. Like it's just simply not entertainment alone. We need closure. Which I guess brings some level of solace to the fact that we have no closure about our own lives when it ends, and we want
to
know that there's a
go to heaven. Our Lord Jesus Christ, what are you talking
some
about?
Some people have closure, and that's wonderful for you.
That's so weird you said that.
It is. You know this thing is a super Christian podcast, right?
Oh man.
Well, it's funny that you say that because now this is our segment called Pray On, and we're just gonna pray on stuff.
Time to tell the good
news. Pray on.
Yeah, pray on. Yeah.
But yeah, like that, I don't know, that told me a lot about myself and what I need out of a story or what I mm-hmm. need out of entertainment, which is, mm-hmm. look, it passed the time while I was sitting in traffic and I was riveted by it for hours. And yet I came out of it feeling like I had wasted my time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, I enjoyed it almost all the way through that.
Because there's an open loop in your brain that wants to able to resolve that. Yeah. And I think, you know, I've said this a million times, but I think it's one of the greatest gifts that Vince Gilligan gave the Breaking Bad fans was, here is the ending in a bow. Here is what happens. And I think, you know, with stuff like True Detective or things that were the... I think showrunners, writers tend to manipulate the audience by kind of presenting what seem to be outlandish premises. And so you go, okay, I'm on board. This feels weird. And I'd love to see how you wrap this up. And then they just get to the end and they realize like, oh yeah, well it's, you know, I think I was writing ahead of myself. It's actually kind of hard. I can't possibly wrap up all of this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
They kind of write weird for the sake of weird because that's intriguing.
Yeah.
But without sticking the landing at the end and going, because that's very hard to do.
It's very hard. Yeah, no, it is.
Without, if you don't know exactly, if you don't exactly have a way to sort of tie up every loose end, and you know.
But I know what you're talking about. You're talking about more of an innate human being's desire for there to be a neat ending, you know.
Because it brings us some level of comfort because we don't have that in our lives.
Yeah, right. No, we don't. Yeah, exactly. We don't know how it ends.
And what about Boyhood? What did you guys think about Boyhood?
I love Boyhood.
I have not seen it yet.
Yeah. Well, it's just like it's one of those kind of slice of life Linklater movies where just like, you know, stuff happens and then it's over.
Well, by the way, I think certain things ended.
I would say nothing really happens and then it's over.
Yeah, nothing really happens, but because it's slice of life, but it does end because the story is of this person's boyhood. His boyhood ends and then he moves on to something else.
That's true.
I don't think it I need finality ending. To someone's life. I just need finality to the story that's being told.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Because Boyhood didn't really set anything up during the movie, there wasn't really much to tie up at the end.
Very true.
You know, sort of like, oh, he's living, and now the credits. But
takes drugs
in
the desert, becomes a man.
That's right. But
well, like the Game of Thrones guys are kind of right in the middle of that right now, which mm-hmm. is that George hasn't finished the books. He hasn't finished the book, and they're careening towards a season in which they're going to have to write without really knowing, because George
Y2K
knows
bug.
but hasn't written it yet. You know, and so. They're writing these stories without knowing exactly what's going to happen
at the
end.
They're going to cross an event horizon where they're going to get ahead of the. They're going to get ahead.
They're getting really close.
Yeah, which is sort of why. That's why I think it was very smart for Walking Dead day one to be like, it's a slightly different universe than the comics, so don't, because it allowed them to have two distinct entities.
And Game of Thrones does that too, where they'll pull the rug out in certain storylines and certain characters. But it stays a little bit more true than I think Walking Dead does.
Yeah. I mean, I feel the same way with you about True Detective, where I did enjoy the ride. I enjoyed the process. I just really... my expectations were in one direction. And then at the end, I was like, well, no, they're just... Now everything's just it's fine. Everything's just fine. Like this guy, the whole
what the fuck.
Far worse, however, though, if they just never found the guy and there was no conclusion whatsoever, like in Syria. Yeah. You know what I mean? Then because at least you've got it ended.
But I don't. I think the other problem, and then you really only get barely a glimpse of the guy, and he's doing weird accents, and you're like, he's crazy, or is it? And I don't know. Like, I wanted there to be.
He was like the boss at the end of a level on a video game. You know what I'm like, that's how it came off to me. Yeah. It's like, oh, that's the weird big guy that you got
to
chuck.
He throws you down and goes like, ha, 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 ha. Yeah. And then, like, you have to hit him three times.
And while he's laughing, that's when you
have to get the. He was King Hippo.
He's basically King Hippo.
But I wanted to kind of delve more into what he was about and how they, and it just sort of, you know.
Ends.
It just ends. Yeah.
On a very strange note.
Yeah.
Yep.
What about like the Sopranos? Did you like that ending?
No. I don't like endings where they go.
I thought it was amazing.
Yeah. I don't like endings where they just kind of go.
It's up to you.
Up to you. Like, no, it's not up to me. You're the fucking writer. It's up to you. Don't, you know, I feel like that's a cop out. Like you cop out when you're writing a book report and you didn't read the whole book, and so you end your book report going, you want to find out what happens, read the book. Yeah. Instead of just going, this is the definitive. I feel like because it's very hard. It's very hard to wrap things up in a satisfying way. And so then I feel like the default is like, just make it weird and open-ended, and then people will assign whatever they want to it.
I think they did an incredible job of kind of giving you the same feeling that, you know, he would have of just kind of not knowing where he stands or if he's going to get killed right away.
I don't want that feeling.
Of course, that's why you never got into a life of crime.
Thinking about it.
That was a taste.
Yeah. Yeah. But they do set that up. They set up at one point in the series is like, the one second you're...
The episode right before.
Yeah, right.
The second to last episode.
He says...
Bobby says, you won't know when it's coming. It'll just be one day you're having dinner with your family, the next minute you're dead.
But didn't the writer...
So there you go. So you know what happens.
But he said... But I think the writer... was it Chase?
Mm-hmm. David Chase, yeah.
Yeah. I thought he said in an interview recently that Tony Soprano does not die. He did. He came out and flat out said like, oh yeah, he doesn't die right there.
I haven't read.
You're shaking your head.
I don't buy that for a second.
He'd be so fucking mad when he said that.
Yeah.
Like, just because to me, I'm. No, I was just pointing at you.
No, Kyle, get it.
I don't know. I take the opposite sort of approach to endings. Like, I really like the True Detective one. I felt like was a compromise because, like, I kind of like the existential way things end. Like, I like Cormac McCarthy a lot, mm-hmm. where he's sort of like you're ruminating on this thing that like. Life, like you were saying, with like life and death, and the way you go is that you want that satisfaction, but you're not getting that satisfaction because neither the characters. Because that's I like a more true to life psychological yeah. approach to narrative, and I think that in something like True Detective, what I kind of had to compromise and take out of it in that last sequence in the hospital is like in life you have these traumas that lead you to these like existential crises about stuff, but you do have these tiny moments where you move on and talk to your family and do other stuff, and it's not resolved and none of it's going to go, but you still have to like learn how the light winning is like, oh, that's right, I can't singularly focus on this thing because it's ultimately kind of meaningless in the long run.
Yeah, but I don't. But that, you know, that to me is an art project. Like, I feel like that's
but,
like.
But
watching...
that's what making art is.
I don't think so. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I think it's different than watching like The Wall, where you're like, oh, I'm supposed to feel all these weird things because that's what he's going through. Like,
yeah.
True Detective does not lead you down that path.
See, I totally saw that.
It leads you down a procedural path.
I always thought breaking down the concept of like a procedural thing. Into the context of having you do this existential thought where it's like the thing they're focusing on is it's a two-hander, it's a magic trick where
right.
they've shown you that what you thought programmed by television and culture was not what they were trying to show you the whole time.
Well,
yeah, I'm kind of with you on
that. Do you also feel like that, first of all, Breaking Bad is probably one of, if not the greatest series in television, yeah. right? I loved Breaking Bad. I loved every second of it. And I loved the finale. But afterwards, I felt like that was great. It was totally satisfying. And I walked away, and I haven't really thought about it since. Because I feel like it closed that loop, and that's done. I'm done with that now.
Mm-hmm.
But I have thought about The Sopranos, you know, once every few months for the past few years. Because it feels like it's still ruminating in my brain, sort of what you were talking about.
Still like fucks
that.
With you.
It still fucks with me. And I feel like
there's something to that.
And whether
yeah.
or not I want it or not is irrelevant because it's what they did.
Yeah. And that's mm-hmm. what you were saying about Boyhood, where it's like, yeah, at first you didn't like it, and then like, but you kept on thinking about it. And isn't that something that like a good entertainment piece should bring you? Just
yeah, I don't have what's to do that.
All this is coming back around to.
I got too many things in real life to think about. I don't have time to be like, where'd they go after the desert? Like, I don't have energy.
Yeah.
I have work. And I just want shit wrapped up.
Yeah, you
my
don't want.
My brain is too feeble to be ruminating on things forever. Like,
if every single series you watched, like, ended that way, you'd have the ghosts of all these things, like, weighing everything. You down.
Yeah, it'd be like Tony Soprano in a bar with Al Swearengen, you know? Like,
right.
They'd be in Cheers together. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just all... Yeah. Like,
but see, that now, this is fascinating because this does not jive with the rest of your life, where you have... willfully discourage yourself from taking those things that bring you instant gratification, whatever it's the alcohol
sure,
or cigarettes or caffeine
sure.
or whatever. You're in it for the long haul, for the more holistic experience of life, right? So sure. Couldn't your art be consumed in the same way?
I like how, by the way, a true storyteller, Rob McElhenney, bringing things back around from the very beginning
to tie
it up in a bow.
Yes,
at the very end.
That's my cue to
have them say it's over and we can get the fuck out of
here. I would say, and that was very skillfully done, I would say that that some things I enjoy that, but you know, a lot of times with television for me, I just kind of need it to be a little I need it to be a little more one-dimensional. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to bleed into my life as much. If I know that's going to be an experience going in, then I'm okay with it. But I don't like being surprised by it at the end and feeling like my expectations were, because in some cases I feel like it can be intentional, and in other cases I sort of feel like it's the writer just kind of copping out because it's very difficult to tie up the million loose ends that they released throughout the life of a series, because they had to keep intriguing people to watch the show, so they had to write weirder and weirder and weirder, and then by the end they're like, well, I can't, it just sort of ends. Yeah, I think some of it's a little Emperor's New Clothes and a little less like, no, man, they're being artistic. In some cases, I think that's the case, but I do agree with your point about Breaking Bad, though. Like, it's the closed loop, and you're like, yeah, I got it.
Yeah.
It's all done.
Yeah.
And now I feel like we're going to end the podcast on an open loop because we didn't really solve anything.
You want to just walk out without saying anything else?
Okay. And then it was just me, Jonah, here by myself for the first time, which seemed like in forever. I learned a lot this podcast in these past 5 years.
But you know what?
It's time for me to do a new thing.
Jonah, turn that off!
Oh, I'm sorry. I was watching what Marathon of Wonder Years. Sorry.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
When you're committed to raising the standard, you're bound to ruffle some feathers. At Happy Egg, we like to say we farm differently. But in reality, we produce eggs the way people used to, by partnering with local small family farmers who raise our happy hens on 8 or more acres. Because in our opinion, farming shouldn't be complicated. It should be happy. Choose happy with Happy Egg. Visit happyegg.com and look for the yellow carton at a store near you.
Happy
Egg.